last night I talked about some of the things that can happen after a retreat, after glow, after shock, both or neither, and talked about some things to try to remember why it's happening and what to do about it. But if you forget why it's happening and what to do about it, there is still one thing that you should remember, and it's very simple. If you forget everything else and you don't know what to do and you're freaking out, here's the one thing to remember. Remember the contact information for a competent coach. You know at least one competent coach now, okay? There are many in the world. Someone you can call or contact that will remind you why it's happening and what to do about it. So my personal contact information will be going up. That means my personal telephone number and my email, plus my websites, basicmindfulness.org, which is for monthly home practice program, and then my YouTube, which is has hours and hours and hours of me answering questions. So that's all available. I live in northern New England in the United States. So it's at this time of year, it is what, a 7 hour?
7 hour
difference.
No, we went back.
Well, it gets complicated. Anyway, you get the general idea. Okay. Who's me? I have no idea. What is the United States? I've been here for a week and I can't even remember. Anyway, doesn't matter. You get the general idea. Figure out the time. Best times to reach me are, well, actually any time. Call me, and here's the problem. I'm away a lot of the time. I'm traveling. If I'm traveling, it's going to be a little while before you can reach me. But you can leave me a telephone number and time translated into the current U.S. East Coast time, a range of times when I can call you back if I'm not there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. The only thing I ask in return for this kind of personal attention is that you maintain a commitment to the rhythm that I talked about, day-to-day practice, and then doing retreats. Doesn't have to be my retreats. I don't care whose retreats you do, but you've got a practice in terms of day-to-day, and then every once in a while you're doing retreats with someone. Then I am not wasting my time in interacting with you because I'm we have a phrase in English, a one-trick horse. It's a horse in a circus that only knows how to do one thing, okay? All I know how to do is mindfulness, so I can't help you with other things. But with that, I have a fair degree of confidence. And so if you have a commitment to doing the structure that I know will bring the results that we want, then I'm very happy to work with you to help you continue along that line. There are many, many, many little questions, and we're not going to have a chance to answer all of those. So I apologize for that. But I think we have answered or gone over what I would consider to be the big questions. The questions are, what is mindfulness? The essence of it. Practices that elevate base level, concentration, clarity, equanimity. Why practice mindfulness? Well, just about every reason that you can possibly think of. It's relevant to your personal happiness, in terms of transcending the body and mind. It's relevant to your personal happiness in terms of getting ordinary happiness based on conditions. It's relevant to mindfulness comes a sense of oneness, and from oneness comes a sense of wanting and being able to serve others for their conditional happiness and also for their unconditional happiness. So all the dimensions, those are the reasons why. So we know what it is, we know why practice it. We also know where you practice it. You practice it in your senses. If you use a traditional Buddhist formulation, the senses are hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, body sensation, and thinking. I chop up the pie a little bit differently, but it's exactly the same thing. I just say, you know, I divide body into touch and feel, I divide mind into image and talk, just to make things more tangible. I sort of group smell and taste with touch. It's the same system. So the where is in your senses. I've given you several hows, how to practice. One is just observe, passive noting. Whatever comes up, you note. You could note ordinary experiences. You could note pleasant, restful experiences. So forth. We also talked about intentionally creating positive. Now, many teachers consider the loving kindness to be sort of separate from mindfulness, but the way I like to define mindfulness, we can include focus on positive or loving kindness as a form of mindfulness practice, because we can show that in its own way, it develops concentration, clarity, and equanimity. So we've answered, as I say, quite a few questions. We've also answered the question, what do you need to be successful with mindfulness? That's what I talked about yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Little day-to-day practice, retreats every once in a while, contact with teachers, and most importantly, time. Okay? I'm not saying it's necessarily going to take a long time, but time is your ally. Once you establish the structure that I'm talking about, the passage of time carries you. Time's going to happen anyway. 5 years from now, you will definitely be 5 years older, 10 years, 20 years, depending on what your age is now. Okay, time is going to pass. In addition, or that the passage of time can mark your growth in extraordinary happiness, or the passage of time can just mark conditional happiness that gets better and then doesn't get good, and, you know, depending on the vagaries of chance and human effort. So the wise person does this practice so that the passage of time is always their ally. Whatever conditions get better, they get worse, they're important, but if you do this practice, you're guaranteed that no matter what, things are going to get better and better for you as time passes. Understanding better in that broad framework. So now we know the what, the why, the where, the how, the necessary factors, and so forth. I would like to speak a little bit about another interrogative, another question word, which is maybe a word you have not heard in English, but there is a word, whence. Whence means from where. Where did mindfulness come from? What is the origin of mindfulness? prehistorically and historically. How did it develop through time? So I'd like to give you as one person once called the book, a sort of brief history of everything, but with regards to specifically mindfulness. We cannot know pre-history by definition. And most of the history of humanity is in fact pre-history. Human beings have been around for an awful long time, hundreds of thousands of years. Some people estimate, a couple million years. We've sort of been making tools, and who knows how long language has been around for, but it's been around for a while, certainly more than 10 or 20,000 years. So most of human experience has been the experience of prehistoric people. Now, we can't say for sure what that was like, but we can make some guesses based on what we know about the life of tribal people. As I mentioned, one of the sort of cool things about coming from the Americas is that although in some sense it's the most recent culture, in another sense it's more... It preserves something more ancient than even here, because we still have people that have not lost their tribal mentality. Although, of course, they speak English and, go to schools and things, but you can find authentic medicine people, that, and you can do ceremonies with them that will essentially put you in a time machine where you go back about 40,000 years. I remember the first time I ever did a sweat lodge, which is, I won't go into the details, but what that's like. But it's the sweat lodge is the representative spiritual ceremony for North America before European people came, and they still go on, and you can participate in this. If you go there, and some Indians come here. In fact, I was going to try to arrange for a medicine man friend of mine to come here to Israel, and I've heard it's done. So in any event, I remember the first time I ever went into a sweat lodge. That was a long time ago. It was like 30 years ago. It was in Arizona, and it's like a Schwitz, okay? Except it, except it's a very spiritual Schwitz. Schwitz is Yiddish. It means a Schwitzbad. Like a sauna. That's correct. Yeah, but in Yiddish it's called a Schwitz, the sweat. sorry, we still speak Yiddish. Okay.
Schwitzer is someone who's like...
Oh yeah? Okay, good. Well, yeah. If you do the American Indian Schwitz, you won't be a Schwitzer anymore. You'll pass out and you won't feel like bragging. Okay, so in any event, first time I did this, it was led by my friend who's the sun dancer. And so it's like at the end of this, they sort of open the door and... I was looking, the sun was going down, the steam was coming out. He was holding his pipe in a long hair, the sun was just like coming in, and he's like a full-blooded Indian, right? And the rays of the sun were just catching his chest full of shamanic scars, okay? And I thought to myself, this is like 50,000 years ago, okay? Nothing has changed. we just went into a time warp. So, in any event, if you consider what the life of our remote ancestors was like, way, way back there, it seems to me that it was characterized by three things. Life was rather simple. Life was rather uncomfortable. And life was full of things you couldn't figure out. So, under those circumstances, what happens? Well, you can sort of go in two directions. One direction is you can start to figure stuff out and figure ways to get more and more comfortable. And we see where that has led. That has led to the development of science, technology, and the world as we now know it, which is wonderful. That's expansion. A price is paid for that, though. Things are not so simple. But when things are simple and uncomfortable a lot of the time and full of mysteries you will never be able to figure out, what's lightning? Why do women bleed once a month? Okay, all sorts of things you just can't figure out why it happens. There's another direction you can go. You can make life simpler for a period of time, make life more uncomfortable for a period of time, and completely surrender to don't know, have equanimity with don't know. That's called a shamanic ordeal. That's a ceremony where you expose yourself to discomfort, and you're so uncomfortable you can't know anything. You can't even know what day it is, and life is very simple. You're beating a drum, you're singing songs, but for tribal people, if you beat a drum and sing songs for a few hours, because life is simple, you go into samadhi. Relatively easily. They go into a highly concentrated state, quickly. Also, it is natural to have, within that cultural context, the natural response to discomfort, hot, cold, injuries, hunger, natural response, equanimity. What else are you going to do? And the natural response to mystery is accept the mystery. Equanimity with don't know. Don't have answers. And so you call God the great mystery. And you give up the need to know. So that's another direction. That's sort of contracting back to the source, which I think probably came to our remote ancestors. Then as civilizations develop, as I say, understanding develops, things get more comfortable, things get more complex. At some point, you can't just beat a drum, drop into equanimity and purify consciousness and experience oneness with the source. It doesn't just happen like that in a few hours or a few days. So people begin to develop more systematic approaches to doing it. That eventually evolves into meditation systems. That's my guess as to how this happened. We can't know for sure because it's prehistoric. What we do know is that about 2,500 years ago in India, there existed a fairly well-developed system for creating states of high concentration. And there also was an ascetical tradition of exposing yourself to discomfort for many reasons. One, because it was thought to purify consciousness, but also it was done in order to see the gods, have shamanic visions, and also it was done basically those two reasons, that it could purify your karma, but also you could get psychic powers through these ascetical practices. About 2,500 years ago, Prince Siddhartha Gautama was born into India with that environment. And he took the tradition of developing the absorptions or high concentration states, and he took the ascetical tradition and he reworked them. He was a creative genius, a spiritual creative genius. And what he discovered was that the issue is not, you don't purify karma by exposing yourself to discomfort with the idea that the more it hurts, the more it purifies. You purify karma by having equanimity with discomfort. And also, by the way, you purify karma by having equanimity with pleasure. So he took the absorption system, the states of high concentration that lead to very blissful states, and he pointed out to people that, okay, you can go into those states of high concentration, but then experience the bliss with equanimity, you'll purify consciousness. And also, the issue is not to make yourself uncomfortable with asceticism in and of itself. The issue is to do some mild sacrifice instead of the intense things that they had done. Mild discomfort, but with a lot of equanimity, you'll get the purification. So he refined the concentration and the asceticism that had come down to him, and he added an element that had never existed before historically, which is, he said, there's another side to concentration. It's not just holding your attention on one thing. You can also develop concentration to be like a microscope where you tease apart, you untangle your sensory experience. He brought in the notion of sensory clarity. So weaving these elements of concentration, equanimity, instead of self-torture, it's now equanimity, and you can do it with pleasure as well as discomfort. And now it's not just pure concentration, but it's also this untangling of sensory experience. Bring that all together, he created a radical new form of spiritual practice, partially based on the past, that probably ultimately goes back to the shamanic past, and then with his own brilliant innovations, created early, what we call early Buddhism. Untangle means take apart something that's all mixed. So this untangling piece is unique, and it's a new discovery. We don't see it mentioned anywhere in history before the Buddha. Essentially, he said that there are certain elements, when they get tangled together, they produce the impression that there is a thing inside us called a self. And we identify that with that and therefore suffer. When you untangle those elements, the impression that there is a thing inside you goes away. So there's no place to hang your suffering anymore. And that's called liberation. Now, this is a little hard to understand. It's deep, actually, extremely deep. I have you analyze feel image talk, okay? Or broadly touch feel image talk. But early Buddhism used some other systems. It's similar, but not identical. Actually, there were several systems. We won't go into the details here. You can look it up on the internet. Those of you that have studied Buddhism are familiar. They used what's called the five aggregates, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four great elements. These are some of these systems in early Buddhism, but essentially it did the same thing that I am doing with the field image talk. When field image talk get tangled and they're unconscious, then they create the impression that there is a person, that that there is a thing called a self. Untangle them, see their essence, and you become free from that. Then what happens to yourself? Well, it becomes free, meaning it's no longer limited to a certain body, a certain mind. It can be anything, everything, nothing, and therefore the nothing that is the source of everything. All of that, that's called a liberated self. So, this was an extraordinary spiritual innovation. And it sort of took India by storm. It spread because not only was it very powerful, but it had new things. It had the old but reinterpreted, and it had some very new things that no one had ever thought of before. In addition to that, it lacked certain things. It didn't have certain things. One of the things it didn't have is a claim to absolute authority. Okay? The Buddha seems to us in many ways to be a very modern person, even though he lived 2,500 years ago. He wasn't a completely modern person, don't get me wrong, okay? He was a creature of his own culture and certainly believed things that probably are not correct, okay? Because everybody in his day believed them. But certain things about him strike us as very modern. For one thing, especially for someone who lived so long ago, for one thing, most spiritual teachers around the world claim authority. They say, believe it because I tell you it's so. Mm-hmm. He didn't do that. That's pretty rare, okay? He said, you don't have to believe something because I say it's so. Why should you believe something? Well, you believe it because it agrees with your direct experience, and it agrees with the consequences of logic. So basically, in ancient India, as in ancient Greece, there were people considered there's three ways that you can know something. You can know from direct experience, you can know from logical inference, and you can know from reliable authority. Okay, here's an example. Reliable authority. Example. There is fire on the mountain. How do you know? I saw it. That's one thing. Okay. There is fire on the mountain. How do you know? There's smoke. Where there's smoke, there's fire. There's smoke on the mountain, therefore there's fire on the mountain. Didn't see the fire, but logic tells you. There's fire on the mountain. How do you know? The village headman, who never lies and is ethically impeccable, said he saw fire on the mountain. Reliable authority. The Buddha said, you know what? There's no such thing as reliable authority. It's just your direct experience and logic. So you don't have to believe it just because I say so. Now that's very unusual, okay? Especially for someone who knew a lot of very special stuff and lived a very long time ago. That strikes us modern people as very refreshing, typically. He rejected the caste system that existed in India, which was a socially unequal system. So depending on your birth, you your economic and educational stature and your society stature was fixed. He said, a person is not noble by the race or the family they're born in. A person becomes noble by the insight and purification they've attained. So he had very modern ideas about social equality and so forth. So he also believed in democratic forms of government, that people a group decision was better than a dictator telling people. So there's just a lot about him that's like remarkably modern. That's appealing. It's appealing to us. Well, it was also appealing to critically minded people 2,500 years ago in India. So it spread. Buddhism spread, and it spread pretty rapidly, and Enlightenment spread pretty rapidly. Not that there wasn't Enlightenment before. There definitely was. It's very evident from the Upanishads and the yogic traditions. But the Buddha had a lot going for him. He had innovations, and he also had new ideas about society and so forth that in some ways questioned the authority of society as it existed, but people were questioning those things. And he had this sort of refreshing attitude of, in Pali the word is ahipassiko. It means come see for yourself. Okay? Like, just see for yourself. That's what you've done. You've come here to see for yourself. You're practicing, you're looking. So this is early Buddhism. Certainly it is true that early Buddhism was deeply spiritual in the deepest sense of the word, because it liberates from the small identity. There wasn't a lot of religion involved. What we normally think of as religion. There were no Buddha statues. There was not a sense of authority, okay? A lot of the things that we tend to associate with religion were not present in the Dharma. He called what he taught Dharma, as you well know. How do we translate Dharma into English? I would say natural spiritual law, if I had to find an English equivalent. Okay, so this is early Buddhism. An extraordinary human creation. But the Buddha was, in some ways, still influenced by his own personal experience and so forth. He tended to see the path in terms of an individual sort of escaping from karma and reincarnation. And it was very much sort of an individual. You as an individual decide to do this, you as an individual decide to become free. There was a lot of emphasis on an individual becoming free. If you look at the example of the Buddha's life, he was rather young when he was enlightened. He was enlightened at the age of 35. And he lived until the age of 80. That means that's 45 years. What did he do during those 45 years? He taught, and he dealt with the inconveniences that brought about, because people objected, people were threatened, people didn't understand, okay? So that's a sacrifice, that's a service, 45 years of service to others. After his enlightenment, he could have just gone off into the Himalayas, been by himself, enjoyed his nirvana, okay? Not be hassled, not have people upset at him, not have people misunderstand him. But he chose to serve for 45 years, wandering throughout India, teaching. So the example of his life is not just an individual becoming free, but an individual who for 45 years served others. However, the philosophy that he taught sort of sounded like it's for the individual. There wasn't a explicit doctrine of serving others. As the centuries passed after the Buddha's death, well, let's put it this way. One of the things that the Buddha taught is that things change, anicca, okay? Things change, but also things can remain the same. Some people held to the early Buddhist system, but other people elaborated or made changes to, in some ways, perhaps improve upon the early Buddhist system. Specifically, there evolved a school of thought that said we should place service to others on the same level as individual liberation. There should be, these should both be stated goals. For the Buddha, the only stated goal was you as an individual get free, get out of here, okay? Find nirvana. So about 500 years after the Buddha's death, there developed something that historically is called Mahayana Buddhism. That means great vehicle. So when you're listening to Mahayana Buddhism, had two features that were new. One feature is that it made an explicit philosophy of serving others for eternity. The goal now be eternity, forever. The goal now in Mahayana is not you as an individual get enlightened and no longer reincarnate. In Mahayana, you get somewhat enlightened and make a vow to reincarnate forever in order to help everyone else. The person that does that is called Bodhisattva. Reincarnate. Gilgul.
What, like in the
afterlife? Yes. Yeah. The Buddha believed in reincarnation.
When they ignore okay.
No, we're not going to go there. Okay. That's been talked about and talked about and talked about. And that's not for tonight, okay? Just the Buddha believed in reincarnation. By the way, that doesn't mean it's true. No, actually not. Christianity is two lives, one now and another one forever. No reincarnation, that's a heresy in Christianity. We're not going to argue about this. We'll never finish tonight, okay? The idea of reincarnation has appeared many, many times in history. That is certainly true. It's also been rejected by religious orthodoxies many, many times. It's certainly rejected by Christianity as a heresy. Okay? Christians do not believe in reincarnation, unless they're New Age, and that's a whole other thing. Okay? Believe me, if you ask the Pope about reincarnation, he's not going to be pleased. Okay. Anyway, the Buddha believed in it. That doesn't mean it's true, but it certainly, he believed in it, and it was a big part of his system. So, maybe it's true. I'm not going to comment one way or another. But in any event, when Mahayana Buddhism developed, the idea was, see, the Buddha's idea was get enlightened and you won't reincarnate. Mahayana said get enlightened and intentionally reincarnate forever so that you can help people forever. It's an explicit philosophy of eternal service to sentient beings. So that's one new feature of Mahayana Buddhism. But there's also another feature. Mahayana developed roughly 1,000 years ago, roughly speaking, 500 years after the Buddha's death. 2,000 years ago, roughly speaking, 500 years after the Buddha's death. With Mahayana, Buddhism starts to look like a religion. You start to get statues, you start to get, the Buddha starts to be looked upon as a kind of god. He's 16 feet tall, has a giant golden body, and the bodhisattvas are people, but the bodhisattvas are also like
demigods.
Yeah, like angels, and they've got statues, and people make offerings and make prayers to them. So Buddhism, Mahayana, is like starting to look like a religion. So things are evolving. While that was happening, some people were still keeping the earlier forms. The ones that kept the earlier forms came to be called, well, let's put it this way. The ones that developed, that had this philosophy of compassion along with wisdom, this philosophy of service, and sort of religious, the style of religion, they called themselves Mahayana. Yana means vehicle. Maha means great or big. Vehicle. So we're Mahayana, so what do we call the other guys? The ones that are keeping to the earlier system, which from our perspective, from Mahayana perspective, is selfish. You just want your own liberation. That's a small point of view, so we'll call you Hinayana, or small vehicle. Okay? So you have now two yanas, two vehicles, in India by about 2,000 years ago. You have the great vehicle with its path of bodhisattva, and you have the small vehicle with its path of arhat. Arhat is the ideal in a small vehicle. You as an individual in this life become liberated and you're out of here. You're in eternity but not serving for eternity. You're outside of time and space forever. So now, what happens? What happens is that both of these practices are coexisting in India. Now, of course, it is Buddhism, okay? So even though they differ in their point of view, they never, like, had a war, okay? They probably never really had a heated argument. It was a different point of view, but they coexisted. They even lived in the same monasteries together. But some people had this Mahayana or great vehicle perspective. Some had the other perspective. Meanwhile, Buddhism is spreading outside of India. Where? Well, primarily east. A little bit west, but primarily east. So what's east? Well, the biggest thing that's east is China. So about 2,000 years ago, Mahayana Buddhism starts to go into China. Now, at that time, China already had 2,000 years of their own culture. China's a very ancient, independent civilization. So now you have this Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism primarily, it's coming into China through the Central Asian trade routes, what's called the Silk Road. Silk is a Chinese invention. There are these trade routes in Central Asia. Some of your grandparents came from Central Asia, okay? If they came, from like Kazakhstan or places like that. So there are these trade routes and they're called the Silk Roads, the Silk Road. Chinese silk managed to get from China through the, those trade routes, and maybe through this area too, I'm not quite sure, but eventually was worn by Roman emperors, okay? Those incredible trade routes. Well, the silk flowed from China to the rest of the world. Buddhism went from India into China along those same trade routes. Very convenient. So, Buddhism comes into China. What does Buddhism look like to Chinese people 2,000 years ago? It looks like a kooky foreign cult. Can you translate? Do you understand what I mean? A kooky foreign, like, okay, so let's put it this way. How do Hare Krishnas look to Haridim? Okay, it's a kooky foreign cult. Okay. Because the Chinese had Confucianism, okay? And it was their own thing, and it's what this stuff from India with the shaved heads and the, in reincarnation and strange deities and whatever, it was very foreign and very strange to the Chinese. It took about 700 years for Buddhism to gradually be digested into Chinese culture. And somebody mentioned that that came about through its sort of cross-fertilizing with Taoism. There was something in China that was somewhat like Buddhism in that it was a mystical path, a path to liberation, and it's Taoism. So Taoism and Buddhism sort of cross-fertilized. Took a long time, and a little bit of Confucianism was thrown in, and this new wonder child, sort of the, you know what hybrid is?
Yeah.
Something like a mixed, you know, your two races mix, and they create a new kind of child that we call a hybrid. Mm-hmm. So this hybrid child of Mahayana Buddhism from India and Confucianism and Taoism and the Chinese spirit. These came together, mated over a long period of time, and gave birth to something called Chan or Zen. Zen in the Japanese pronunciation, Chan in the modern Chinese pronunciation. In Korean it's called Sun, S-O-N, and in Vietnamese it's called Tien, T-H-I-E-N. East Asia, China's the center. You've got also, though, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. That's one Kulturkreis, one culture sphere. So what happened was a really new form of practice arose, a sort of Mahayana, but very, very East Asian and very distinctive, with its own practice modes. Distinctive. That's Zen. Now, so Zen is sort of the surviving representative of Mahayana Buddhism, but it's a very modified form of Mahayana Buddhism. Meanwhile, the Hinayana Buddhism spread primarily in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, Laos, Cambodia, and so forth, primarily. It's more complicated than that, but you can think of it that way. Early Buddhist practice, which is essentially mindfulness practice, that early period preserved itself primarily in Southeast Asia. The middle period, the Mahayana development, went into East Asia, was greatly modified, and is now preserved as, shall we just call it by its Japanese name, Zen. So now you have sort of mindfulness in the Hinayana Buddhism preserved in Southeast Asia. You've got a modified form of Mahayana that is the Zen practice associated with East Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam. Then in India, Mahayana, the great vehicle, continues to evolve. And it evolves for about 700 years. And, you know, by, let's say, roughly speaking, the year 700 AD, very, very roughly speaking, Mahayana has evolved into something called Vajrayana. Vajra means a diamond, the diamond vehicle. Vajrayana goes into the Himalaya area and into Tibet, where it becomes dominant. Now, the actual history is much more complicated than this. I'm giving you a very simplified overview of time and space. Tibet and Nepal preserve the latest form of Indian Buddhism called Vajrayana. That evolved from Mahayana. Mahayana evolved ultimately from Hinayana. By the time Mahayana turns into Vajrayana, it's a full-blown religion with elaborate mythology, elaborate pantheon of deities, okay? A hierarchical, authoritative priest structure, the whole nine yards, okay? It's a religion, big time. It also has some very powerful practices that did not exist in early Buddhism. Innovations, ways of working with altered physiology, ways of using feel image talk, okay, by visualizing deities and becoming deities in order to gain insight now, remember, not to go crazy or to channel, but as a liberation practice. A lot of really distinctive, interesting things, extremely complicated, very iconic, lots of artwork and whatever. It's its own thing, okay? So that's the Vajrayana, but that goes back to India. And it preserves in Tibet essentially late Indian Buddhism. Go to Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, and so forth, you've got preserved early Indian Buddhism. Go to East Asia, you've got middle Indian Buddhism really changed by Chinese culture as Zen. So roughly, when you look at the modern world geographically, in Southeast Asia, you have small vehicle, and the main practice is what we're doing here. It's like what we're doing here. In East Asia, you have Zen. There's much more to it than that, but roughly speaking. And that's a really distinctive practice, and there are different lineages within Zen and so forth. And then you've got the Vajrayana in Tibet. So Southeast Asia preserves the early form. Tibet preserves the latest form that evolved in India, and East Asia has modified sort of the middle period form, the Mahayana form.
The connection between Hinayana and Theravada?
They're the same thing. Theravada is another name for Hinayana Buddhism. This is an oversimplification. There's more to it than that, but roughly speaking. So there's a representative practice of, let's put it this way. Theravada is the representative school of Hinayana, and the representative meditation technique of Theravada is what we're doing here. It's mindfulness practice. What's the representative meditation technique for Zen? Well, it sort of depends on which school of Zen. If it's Soto Zen, you do a practice called just sitting. That's the technique that I call do nothing. If it's Rinzai Zen, you'd work with don't know mind. You're given a problem that your mind can't can't think through, and so you have to have equanimity with don't know. I've talked about this many times. what is the sound of one hand clapping? Okay. before you were born, you had a face. Show it to me. Now! Okay. don't know. Stay with that. Stay with that. What do you mean? I don't understand what you're saying. Yeah, stay with that. Stay with that. Stay with that. Don't know. Okay. That's a whole other way to practice. Very different from India. Okay. That's a Taoist sort of way of working. There's much more to it than that. Much more to it than that. But I'm trying to give you a grossly oversimplified view of the big picture here. So, and what's the representative practice for Vajrayana Buddhism in Tibet, the Tibetan Buddhism? Well, two things. And both of them are secret. But I will happily give away the secret to you. I don't care what anybody says. I'll tell the secret because I know the secrets. There are two secrets. The first secret is the claim you can become a Buddha in this lifetime immediately. That's the big claim, but you have to understand what that means. By the time Vajrayana was developing, to quote become a Buddha means to become a god. Now the idea was, well, if you accumulate merit over billions and billions of lifetimes, you'll be born 16 feet high with a golden radiant body, blah 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 blah. But you can do it right now, in a few years, with the secret practice. So what's the secret practice? You visualize yourself as having that body. And you replace your internal talk with the mantra that goes with that deity. And you visualize the deity in front of you also. So it's deity facing deity. And instead of, with your eyes closed, instead of seeing the room where you are, you visualize you're in a celestial palace. And with touch space, you make mudras. And with feel space, you make the feel of the deity. You work with your body-mind, manipulating it. And you will actually have the experience of being a god. Not in, as I say, as I always say, this is not insanity. Sometimes it is. When people think they're a god, they're just insane. Neither is it shamanism. It's not channeling. It's creating an alternate mythological identity and then taking it apart. And then creating another one and taking it apart until you realize the true nature of self, which is there is no fixed self. It's just the early Buddhist, it's the same insight as early Buddhism, but a very different way of going about it. That's secret number one. Secret number two is there are certain practices that alter your physiology and produce certain unusual experiences. You do those practices, they're hatha yoga practices, but then you see that those deep altered physiological states are in fact empty space. And that's called the union of bliss and void. The union of bliss and void. You understand, this is very technical and complicated, don't worry about it. Anyway, it's secret, you're not supposed to know. Huh? It's the union of bliss and void. You alter your physiology producing a kind of bliss, but you realize that it is empty. And why would you want to do that? Why would you want to do that? Because it brings your realization of emptiness down to a physiological level of your body. That's the second secret. Now you know the two secrets of secret Buddhism. That's not to say that you even remotely understand them, but that's it. Okay? So, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. Diamond vehicle, yes.
The promise to join practice in 5 years.
That's right. And they are justified in that promise. In the sense that I just said. Don't worry about it. We're not going to go there. That's one of the deities that's visualized. In Vajrayana.
And it's mine.
That's part of the complexity that I would prefer not to go into tonight when I said I was going to give you a gross oversimplification. That's part of Mahayana. That's the quick answer. That's a Mahayana deity.
What's a deity?
That comes from Hinayana Buddhism, Theravada. The term is a term in, that's the word that they use for the meditation system. So the lineage is called Theravada or Hinayana, but the meditation system is called Vipassana. So it's that's the system used, that's the way to meditate used within the historical tradition called Theravada. Is that clear? Good. Okay. So, meanwhile, what's happening in India? Well, around the year 1200, roughly speaking, Buddhism is destroyed in India by various forces, but the main one is Islamic invasion of India. So Islam had been coming into India for many centuries, but around the year 1200, roughly speaking, is when Muslim armies conquered the provinces of Bihar and Bengal, which are the heartland of Buddhism. And they destroyed the Buddhist monasteries. And essentially destroyed Buddhism on its native soil. Fortunately, from our point of view, before that happened, Buddhism had propagated into Southeast Asia, into East Asia, and into Tibet, where, in various forms, it has been preserved for us to today. Specifically, in Southeast Asia, there are various ways of doing practices that are similar to what the Buddha taught. They're not identical, but they're along the same lines. These are the various lineages of mindfulness or vipassana. So, what you got from me at this retreat is based on several of those lineages, which I have sort of torn apart and put back together again, with a little bit of dose of Zen, and also a little dose of Vajrayana, believe it or not, because my initial training for 3 years, the first 3 years of meditation that I did, was not Vipassana, and it was not Zen. It was Vajrayana. I won't go into the details, but I sort of reversed Buddhist history. I did Vajrayana, then I did Zen, now I sort of am basically in the mindfulness mode. But I've been influenced by all three vehicles, and I've been influenced by modern science. So lots of different things come in. So you're getting a modernized, westernized, and modified way of doing mindfulness. But I would claim that it's essentially the kind of thing that the Buddha taught. Because he taught concentration, clarity, and equanimity. He taught untangle the atoms and you'll become free. It's, you know, it's along the lines of what he taught. In Southeast Asia, the two major styles of doing vipassana come from 20th century Burma. One is the Mahasi Sayadaw lineage, which involves noting with mental labels, and that's where I got that. And the other is the Ubakin lineage, which involves sweeping the awareness through the body. And I learned a lot from that too. The importance of body sensation, the whole theory of how consciousness is transformed, the sankskaras, the equanimity piece, etc. I picked all that up from Mr. Goenka, who is the most prominent teacher of the Ubakin lineage. But I picked up the noting methods and so forth from various Burmese teachers that I knew who were in the Mahasi Sayadaw lineage. However, there are many, many more styles of doing vipassana. Upandita is Mahasi. Upandita is the main disciple of Mahasi Sayadaw. No, the other way around. Mahasi Sayadaw was Upandita's teacher. But there's other lineages. There's the Taungpulu lineage. There's the Sunlun lineage. There's the Taungpulu way of doing it. There's the Sunlun way. There's Ajahn Chah way. There's many, many styles of doing vipassana. Yes, that's correct. Laos, actually. Yeah, Jack's teacher is Ajahn Chah. So if you go to Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, you'll find many different ways of doing vipassana. Jack Kornfield wrote a book, Living Buddhist Masters. It's got 12 different ways to do vipassana, some of them really quite different. Which one is the true one, the correct one, the pure one? Well, we'll let people argue about that, okay? But the fact is, there's something they all have in common. I've said it over and over and over again. They all will develop your concentration, clarity, and equanimity. It's just they'll have you do it in different ways. They'll have you use different methods. Some will, like Buddhadasa, there's a name, okay? Buddhadasa was one of the great living Thai masters.
He's a Christopher Fitness
teacher. Oh, is that correct? Okay, there you go. So you're in that lineage. Now, I don't know how, I don't know some of you anyway. I don't know how Christopher teaches specifically, but Buddhadasa was breath all the way. I mean, it was like the breath is the way to nirvana, okay? And the Buddhadasa was that's interesting. I didn't know that. He was a really interesting teacher. In some ways, very unusual for a Thai monk in his style. Okay, it's a lot of humor, creativity, and so forth. So, anyway, you now have the big picture. This is where it came from, okay? Going back to our prehistoric ancestors and then, you know, coming down through the yogic tradition and ascetical tradition in India, modified by the Buddha in really major ways, and then evolving through time, propagating through space. Here we are in Eretz Israel. Doing this, which is pretty amazing. Tomorrow, now that we know where it came from, we're going to speculate on where it's going to. final question.